Good evening, everyone. And as I said last week, I like to begin these classes by taking a little time for any questions you might have based on what we talked about last week. Can you hear me okay, everyone? Is it working okay? It feels a little bit funny to me, this speaker to me. Does it feel okay to you? Sound okay to you? You can't hear? Very hollow? Yeah, it's kind of funny. We need more people. We can try not using it. Because it's kind of funny to me. So I could speak louder. Does it seem to be okay? We have an extra speaker in here. Can you turn that speaker off? That's usually out in the hallway there, and so it might be that it's giving some kind of feedback. Maybe, great. Let's try it on. So let's see, we'll try again now. Is that better? We don't have that hollowness anymore? I think that was the problem is that speaker. That usually speaker's usually up there in the outer hallway. So as I said last week, I'd like to take the beginning of each class to take a few minutes to see if there's any questions anybody has about the practice or the instructions or what I said the week before. Ideally, you're doing this practice at home in between our classes. And so it'd be nice to hear how it went. And part of the advantages of this is then I hear a little bit how it's going. So then when I'm teaching, I can kind of respond to who you are, what your experience is, as opposed to me just assuming I know who you are and giving idealized instructions for, you know, whatever. So does anyone have any questions or any concerns or any reports from last week or from your practice? Any difficulties or... Yeah.
Well, I noticed last week when the woman spoke and talked about how when she first started, she could only stay with her breath for 4 minutes. And my experience is, you know, I can only stay with my breath maybe 4 breaths before I take off.
Yes. Yeah, that's often how it is. So there's two things. One is we consider it valuable that you start seeing that. You see how powerful the mind is, how strong will it has, or kind of mind of its own it has. And so you see that. Wow, you know, I don't have much control over my mind. This is phenomenal. I thought, you know, I was my mind, and I realized my mind has me. So it's valuable to see that and not to blame yourself or feel bad about it. Just, oh, this is really fascinating. Wow. And then the second thing to say is that over time, your ability to get concentrated, stay in the present, will improve. And you'll probably find as you keep doing it week after week that ability to stay present become easier and easier and something you actually cherish, something you find great value for yourself. And it's really best to be patient. One of the spiritual qualities that meditators will develop sooner or later, and usually it's sooner rather than later, is patience. And patience is something that's greatly needed by many people in the modern world. We expect instant results. And that's to be underscored, that many of us are used to getting very quick results and, you know, getting things that work right away. And the inner life, the spiritual life, has really its own rhythms and its own time frame. And if you give it your best effort, you have to be very patient about when things kind of change or bear fruit or how they develop on their own. And if you expect that you can kind of just will your way into some deep samadhi or some deep concentration, it doesn't work that way. And it might be that the first lesson you need to learn before is kind of surrendering your will. And once you've done that, then maybe you can get concentrated. Yes?
I feel like I have to swallow all the time. I don't know if anybody else has that distraction going on, but I'm very distracted by feeling like my throat. Yeah. I don't know, is that normal?
I wouldn't say it's normal, but I would say that it's common. And there's it's common. So, you know, it's something I'm quite familiar with, happens to a lot of people when they start to meditate or various points in their meditation. There's various reasons that it might, by swallowing a lot and a lot of saliva production might be happening. But I could offer you some of those reasons, but the way to respond is basically the same regardless. And that is just let it be that way and swallow mindfully. You know, don't make it a problem. Just, you know, just let it be as it is. And probably it'll work itself out after a while. Are you a new meditator?
Well, fairly, but I mean, even before I started coming, I noticed when I was trying.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, fairly.
Yeah. So it could just be part of the transition period of sometimes there's physiological things that happen in adjustment. And so I wouldn't be too concerned about it. Occasionally, what we see is that someone has had some kind of traumatic experience that somehow affects the area around their throat and their neck, that might affect their breathing in some way or affect their swallowing in some way, and sometimes there's something so we have to work a little bit differently with that person, but there's generally that's not the case. Usually, it's just something, you know, it's part of the transition.
I read it somewhere that the fact that we put the tongue in the palate will help to stop the saliva.
Yeah. So the instructions I gave last week of putting the tongue against the roof of the mouth sometimes can help with that. Sometimes what also can help is, for some people, is simply not giving in to the urge to swallow, even though it fills with saliva in your mouth. And somehow just waiting, not, you know, letting it just kind of build and be there for a while will help regulate and come to a kind of more normal. Yeah.
It's sort of hard to let go of control when I'm paying attention.
Right. If it's easy enough to let go of the control, great, let go of it. But if it's not easy to let go of, then just be content that you're becoming aware of what a controlled breath feels like. Because what can happen is if you're not kind of content, if you're bothered by that and feel like it's not right, then we can tie ourselves in knots. And we try harder not to control it. The more we try, the more we do. And it's just downhill from there. And there's nothing inherently wrong with controlling the breath. There's no reason. I mean, for the purposes of mindfulness, you can develop mindfulness with a controlled breath or with an uncontrolled breath. And so we don't care. So our encouragement is that you don't care. Just, oh, this is interesting. Now it's controlled. Wow. Well, how does that happen? How's that working? What does that feel like? What's that? Let me hang out with that for a while. As opposed to, oh, no. This shouldn't be that way. A spiritual person should just, you know, have a natural breath. Yeah?
I find myself healthy when I breathe. I guess I'm not looking for a value judgment. I'm just wondering. I didn't hear you say anything about that last week.
I didn't say anything. There are meditation techniques where counting the breath is part of the technique. So some people probably have done that. Like in Zen tradition, sometimes they teach people to count from 1 to 10, and then to start over again. Or if you count to, you know, if you don't make it to 10 but lose count, then you're instructed forget about trying to figure out where you're at. Just start over again at 1. And in fact, one Zen teacher in Japan taught his students to count all the way to 1 and then start over again, and just over and over again 1, 1. That way it's hard to lose track. And so counting is one way of stabilizing the mind, concentrating the mind on the breath. It's kind of a little extra, activity of the mind to keep us on track. And we know when we're slipping and kind of encourage us to stay there. And occasionally, for various reasons, I'll recommend to mindfulness students to count their breath. One of the reasons it's interesting for Vipassana students is if you've been doing practice for a long time, sometimes we can trick ourselves into thinking we're much more concentrated than we are. And if you start counting, you find out actually you weren't that concentrated because you can only get to 5 or 6 and then you keep losing track. How high are you counting?
Well, it varies, but 20s, but I also sort of do this thing where I have a cadence on the breath. Right? Uh-huh. I'll count to 6 on an inhale and
that way.
On an exhale. And
I see. Well, those things are all helpful for concentration. It's okay to do. But for the purposes of mindfulness, we prefer you not do that. Because what we're trying to do is develop our capacity to observe what's happening, not to interfere or try to make something special happen. So it's maybe more useful to learn what the unconcentrated mind is like, rather than having this little technique to get you concentrated. And by learning what the unconcentrated mind is like, then you can find a more natural way of getting concentrated. There are generally two different ways a person can get concentrated. One is through an act of will, essentially. You kind of hold your mind on the object. And the other way of getting concentrated is you pay attention to the forces that distract you and settle those. And so those get settled away. Then you fall into a natural state of concentration. So the Vipassana, the mindful way, is more the second. We learn to pay attention to the forces that keep us distracted. Rather than making them the enemy, they became the subject of meditation, which will become clear in the weeks that follow how that works.
So that begs my question. Is there a sort of intermediate, something maybe a little more actionable?
What we recommend as a way of aid to concentration and also to mindfulness is to very subtly, in the whisper in the back of the mind, to label the in-breath and the out-breath. So there is some activity of the mind. That part of the mind that thinks is thinking about the breath rather than thinking about Tahiti. And so it's kind of a little bit engaged in a more useful thing. And it's so simple and rudimentary, the thought, that it's even more rudimentary than counting to 10, for example, because then you have to keep track. And so it's a very, very, very subtle kind of nudging of the mind to stay present on where you want it to be. So with the in-breath, we'd simply say in, on the out-breath, out, or rising as the belly or chest rise and falling. And this thing we call this mental noting or labeling. And that becomes something that some Vipassana, some mindfulness students find very, very helpful. And we'll use it, we'll talk more about it as we go along. We'll use it a lot in their practice, not just for the breath, but for other things they pay attention to. And some people find that it doesn't work so well for them to do the noting. It kind of keeps them more agitated. But I would encourage you all to try it. And it's kind of like riding a bicycle. It is kind of agitating to try to learn to ride it. But once you learn the skill of it, then it becomes second nature, and you can do it without using your hands even. So the same with the mental noting. It can seem awkward at first, especially if someone comes from another meditation practice where you're used to having a more silent mind. But if you kind of get the hang of it, it can be, for a lot of people, very, very effective for helping both concentration and the mindfulness together. So there's that. That's what we have. And
I have a question about music. I find if I've been listening to a CD for a while, that it seems like for a week or two afterwards, I have a piece of music, sometimes the same one, sometimes different pieces, running through my head all the time, regardless of what I'm doing. And it's even more noticeable if I'm doing something rhythmic, like walking or focusing on my breathing, because I tend to then match that up to some rhythm. And I don't listen to music that much, so it's sort of hard for me to judge. This is the way everybody is all the time. But I'm sort of curious. I kind of feel like, it's not exactly like I'm thinking about the music. It's just sort of there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, if the mind will do all kinds of interesting things if you meditate. The mind is fascinating. And that's one of the things. It's the various things it does with music. And the best thing to do is, if there's some kind of repetitive thing with music, is to know, to be aware of the phenomena there. Everything is just something else to be known, to be aware of in mindfulness. And then basically just to let it be in the background if you can. And don't be bothered by it, don't be disturbed by it. Try to see if you can keep the music from interfering with your breath, for example. You're kind of adjusting your rhythm to go with the breath, or you start tapping your feet. Just kind of try to leave just in the background, kind of like background music or something. What happens to some people is that long-forgotten songs, or maybe not so forgotten, will come back when they're meditating. And just over and over again, some song, you know, from 20 years ago, just give me a break, you know, what's going on here? And the mind is all very fascinating what it does. And again, the best thing to there is just notice what's going on. Don't be bothered by it. And just try to go back to your breathing and just let that be in the background and just let it be as it is for the most part. Kind of one of the principles that helps meditation a lot is something you probably hear a lot from me is try not to be bothered by anything. And, you know, nothing needs to be the enemy or be a problem. It's all stuff for the practice. Okay, so let's do some meditation. So make yourselves comfortable in an alert, upright posture. Softly close your eyes. And take a few moments just to take stock of how you are right now. Nothing fancy. No need to be different than how you are. Just very kind of matter-of-factly be aware of your body, your mind, your heart. Just simply how it is. And then to begin a session, it's often helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths, connecting to your body from the inside as you breathe in, relaxing as you exhale. Two, three, four of these deep breaths. Letting your breath return to normal. It can also be helpful to take a few moments to scan through your body to see if there's any easy or obvious places where you can relax your muscles. I often do it from top down, so starting in the area of the forehead and the eyes. If you can't relax, maybe at least soften, or at least be accepting of what's there. Some people can soften the muscles of their nose, their cheeks, area around their mouths. Also the jaws. Especially as you exhale, it's a good point to let go or relax the muscles. It's a natural letting go at that point. Some people carry a lot of tension in their shoulders. And if it's easy enough at the beginning to soften your shoulders, your shoulder blades, perhaps as you exhale. Sometimes if people can relax the chest, the rib cage, area of the diaphragm. And in particular, it can be helpful to soften the belly, to give in to gravity and let the belly hang down and forward. And finally, the whole area below the waist, including your legs, your feet, relax or surrender them to gravity. Let their weight, feel their weight, and relax with them as you breathe out. And then within your body, as part of your body, becoming aware of your breathing. Feeling how your body experiences breathing, how your body moves with the in-breaths and out-breaths. If you have trouble experiencing your body breathing, you can place your hand on your belly or on your chest, so you can get a sense of the movement there, the expansion and contraction. And I'm going to list four different basic ways you can experience your breathing, that you might then choose whichever one seems most natural to you. One is you primarily experience the breathing in the movements of your abdomen, rising and falling. The second is you might experience your breathing primarily in the area of your chest, the middle of your chest. Again, lifting and falling, rising and falling, expanding, contracting. Or you might be aware of your breathing at your nostrils, maybe in the back of your throat, as the air moves in and out there. And the fourth way is to just be aware of the whole breath body, the way the whole body responds to breathing. Kind of following the experience and tracking it through your body. More of a global experience of breathing. Any of these four ways is fine. But if one of them seems most obvious to you, most prominent to you, then the encouragement is for you to make that your primary way of paying attention to the breath during meditation. So you can develop some stability or continuity in this one way. inevitably your mind will wander off in thoughts. When you notice it, just have a very simple acknowledgement that you've been thinking, and then in a very matter-of-fact way, begin again with your breathing. Connect to your breathing, and then hang in there with your breath. Hang out with the rhythms of breathing, in and out. In the softest natural way that you have, label each breath, each in-breath in, out-breath is out. Or rising, falling. And as you do that, keep track of one breath after the other, letting the breathing, the mindful breathing, help to calm your body and mind, settle it. Especially with the exhalation, remember to let go of your thoughts that have crept in. No need to be concerned about how well or how poorly you're doing. Meditation doesn't belong to the realm of activity that can be judged poorly or well. It is what it is. And your job is just to notice how it is, to be there as it is, offering your best effort without really any concern about how well you do. Letting go of your thoughts. being with the body's experience of breathing, one breath after the other. Be aware of the transition from breathing out to breathing in. Not to force it or just do anything with it, but simply notice it there. Notice perhaps how the in-breath begins by itself. And now, continuing to meditate for a few more minutes, let go of paying attention to your breathing. And instead, bring your attention to the strongest sensation in your body. It doesn't have to be strong, just whatever qualifies as the strongest. And see if you can bring a very simple awareness there, as simple as you can, to just feel it as it is. Kind of an accepting awareness. The kind of awareness that doesn't need for it to be different. It's okay for it to be there. And see how close you can bring the awareness to the strong sensation. Maybe looking at it from different angles, in a sense, or feeling it. Noticing what happens to it as you're present for it. As you're present for it, one of two things might predominate. Either the sensation itself, the physical sensation, or the reaction you have to the sensation. The attitude, the judgment, the interpretation, the emotion. It's fine to notice either one. If the sensation goes away as you're present for it, then find the next strongest sensation. Hang out with that. See if you can bring a meditative awareness to the sensation. Noticing what happens if you just very simply bring an accepting awareness of whatever is the strongest sensation. And now letting go of physical sensations in your body. For the last minute or so of the meditation, become aware of sounds. Letting the sounds be as they are, accepting them as they are. A meditative awareness of sounds. So one of the approaches to talking about this practice of mindfulness is to distinguish between the foreground and background of awareness. And what we try to do is to bring our attention, our meditative awareness, to whatever is in the foreground of attention. Another way of saying this is whatever is predominant, whatever predominates in awareness, whatever is most compelling. So in the beginning of meditation, we place, in a sense, the breath in the foreground of attention. We give some commitment to the breath, trying to be with it. But sooner or later, something else, a lot of things might be in the background. Songs might be in the background, thoughts might be in the background, sounds, sensations in the body, feelings. As long as they're in the background, you don't have to do much about them. Just be aware they're there or not, and just stay with the breath. Sooner or later, something from the background, in a sense, will come in into the foreground, become more foreground than the breath, or kind of compete with the breath in a sense. And then if you're trying to stay with the breath at that point, then you're setting up kind of a tension or competition. between the breath, where you think you're supposed to be, and this other thing which is kind of asking for attention, which is compelling, which is predominant. And then you can get you can set up a tension and frustration sometimes. So that's not interesting for us. What we do then is just let go of the breath and take this other experience as the subject of meditation, just as the breath was the subject of meditation before. So we bring the meditative awareness to that particular thing. So for today, we're going to talk about the body, body sensations. So if a body sensation comes into the foreground of attention, then you can be very contently let go of the breath, let that be in the background, and just bring your attention very carefully, fully as you can, on the particular physical sensation that's strong, that's predominant. It can be uncomfortable or comfortable. It can be a pleasant or unpleasant sensation. It doesn't really matter for the purposes of mindfulness. What matters is you bring your attention to it. So in this last meditation, I asked you to bring your attention to the strongest sensations in your body. What happened to some of you when you did that? Were there some? Were some of them happened to be more predominant than your efforts to be with the breath? What happened when you then switched from the breath to focusing on those? Yes?
Well, I was having like a tension in the back of my neck, and when I focused on it,
There's three things that might happen to physical sensations when we bring our attention to them. One is they go away, they weaken or go away. The other is they get stronger. And the third is they stay the same. And it's not our job to be concerned which one it is. Because some people are really looking, kind of holding on, grasping for, can I get this pain to go away? Our job is really to be like naturalists who don't want to interfere with the natural subject they're studying, but just want to say, what is this? What is the animal of pain like? What's the animal of physical delight and pleasure like? What is it? Just kind of without interfering with it, just sensing and seeing what it is. Other experiences when you switch to the sensations. What was that like? Was it difficult, easy? Was it helpful to keep you in present more or not present?
I noticed that my judgment can be really subtle, in me anyway. So in this instance, the first like feeling of what back was sort of hurting, and then so judgment was kind of subtle. Well, that's not a good one. But not very subtle. Okay, well, in between my shoulders. I imagine you're going to talk about judgment of what you're doing next week with emotion, but I've just noticed it can be quite subtle.
It can be very subtle. And as I said in the meditation, there's two things you might be aware of if you bring attention to the sensations. You might be aware of the sensations itself more clearly as it is. The other thing you might be aware of is how you're relating to that sensation. Like, for example, it might be judgment. There might be expectation. There might be demands. This better go away, or I'm going to do Sufi dancing, or something, do something else. And, we have all kinds of, attitudes, ideas, feelings, hate. I hate it. I love it. I can't wait to tell my friends about this great pleasure I felt in meditation. Or I can't wait, I can't wait to get out of here. there's all these ideas that come into play. So noticing those is part of what the meditation is, to see it very clearly. Because if you can see it clearly, then you have the opportunity of not being hooked by it, not being pulled into its world, into its realm, into its world. Often the mind, or we ourselves, are dragged around by our judgments, our reactions, our views, our prejudices, and our emotional reactions. And it's fine to have those things, in a sense, but we can be independent of it. So we have some choice about whether to believe it or to go along with it or to act on it. And if we don't have that choice, then we're going to be dragged around by them, and it's going to be really tiring. We put a tremendous amount of stress on us, and we're not going to be free. That makes sense? So seeing the subtlety is great. It helps you become more free. Maybe not today, but with time. Yes, please.
When I went to the retreat last December, I was able to really feel my heart beating in my body for the first time. And I sometimes use that as kind of an anchor in between breaths. I have, for myself, naturally a very, very long space between in and out.
Great.
But so I chose that as the thing to focus on, and this has happened to me before when I focus on my heartbeat. It's such a subtle, and it's something that's actually kind of like almost rocking my body. And it's such a deep experience inside my body that my awareness kind of goes away. It's like almost like I'm up into the experience of the beat more. And I lose that kind of watching self if I stay with it for a long time. And then I have to drop off to sleep or, well, not necessarily, but then I get into more of a hazy space. That's the experience I have.
What you're describing is an experience of getting more and more concentrated, absorbed in your experience, which in and of itself can lead to dullness, sleepiness, lethargy, kind of a sinking mind. An experience is fine to have, but you want to make sure you have enough energy to match the level of calm or concentration that's coming with it. So you have to you have to somehow track that, and then know you have to apply yourself, bring more energy, more vitality into the experience. So there's a balance of calm and effort. Maybe a little more effort. And one of the ways to make more effort is to bring a little bit of an inquiry into what's the nature of this experience here. A little bit kind of, you know, like you're a naturalist. And, you know, what is this experience like? And that sometimes can bring enough alertness in the mind that the concentration you have won't put you to sleep. Make sense?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, I found my body either sort of just slowly leaning forward or slowly leaning back as I was trying to fall into the meditative state.
It could be. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I certainly felt like pretty unconscious at those moments.
Yeah, so then probably you were falling asleep or kind of losing your sense of presence. I mean, in order to keep the body upright in a balanced, aligned way, generally there has to be a fair amount of presence in your body. And so people who slump a lot, for example, lean over, they might be getting relaxed, but then often there's not an adequate enough presence in their body. And for the body to be the right kind of tension is the wrong word because we associate that with stress, but tautness or right balance kind of in the muscles, there has to be some kind of presence within the body. And that presence within the body is partly what mindfulness is. So rather than getting in the way of the meditation, simply coming back and establishing that presence in your body and staying there is helpful. And then it builds over time. It becomes kind of a stability. And then at some point, you'll see the concentration, enough concentration or enough alertness will kick in that it becomes automatic that you'll stay upright. You don't have to make any effort anymore. But it's good to use this as an indication that maybe you need to be more alert. Yes?
I was just wondering where, sort of balancing the drifting, sort of it's almost a sort of sinking, almost a submersion sort of sensation, where maybe I don't fall asleep, it seems like I got pretty close. I guess being, where's it you said, balancing calm and the energy, sort of bringing energy into it without sort of having that be a distraction.
Right.
I'm not sure, when does following a thought become not a distraction?
Well, you don't need to, there's no thoughts I think you need to really follow.
Sorry?
I don't think you need to follow any thoughts when you meditate, but see, a lot of people associate meditation with becoming calm. And sometimes people even try to soothe themselves with meditation, sometimes very subtly with the breath, kind of soothe themselves with the breath, because that's what they want, partly because they need it very much. A lot of people are stressed in our society, and they come to meditation for that purpose. And it's great to find some practice that helps calm and de-stress and all that. But if a person is emphasizing that too much, then that will tend to put the person to sleep or make the mind really dull, or you know, kind of sink into kind of a blackness or kind of into an unuseful state. And so you have to be on alert that you're not being... that. And so the balance of effort and calm is one where you still are very aware, very alert to what's actually happening in the moment. A motorcycle goes by, and you're aware that there's a sound going by. It isn't like afterwards, what was that? You know, something went by, you know, afterwards. But you're really alert, you know. It's like the lights are on in the room and you really see. As opposed to the lights going down, 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 you hardly see it anymore at all. So there's ability to recognize what's going on. But it's a very simple recognition. It's not any more complicated recognition than if we turn the lights off here and everybody rearranged themselves, you turn the lights on again, you'd be able to recognize, you know, that now there was a man sitting next to you where before there was a woman. I mean, that doesn't require much thinking, does it? It's kind of like almost, it is a kind of cognitive activity, but so, so simple that the alertness at least makes you aware of that. So bringing that balance of effort so that if you're getting too calm, part of what you want to bring in terms of more effort and energy back in is the energy to be alert enough to notice what's happening. And if you're really sleepy in meditation, then what you try to do is, it's kind of like a little bit of a judo where you go with your opponents, is you try then to become alert of what it feels like to be sleepy. Yes?
I had a little more prosaic experience, but just like notice sensations in your body, I realized my whole leg had fallen asleep. And then I started to sort of become very concerned with that. And how much longer can I sit here with my leg? Last week you mentioned that frequently happens to people.
Yeah.
Just sit with it and see what happens.
Generally, that's the advice we give. I mean, within reason. If it begins hurting a lot, or if you're really agitated, you're welcome to adjust and, you know, do that. But you know, it's kind of cute, right? Because it didn't bother you until I brought your attention to it, right?
Exactly.
And then suddenly, this mental flurry.
It's horrible.
Horrible, right. And then another variation of that is people are sitting in meditation that this is the worst pain I've ever had and I can't sit still for another moment. I better get up and bolt. I better do something. And I'm going to, you know, kill the meditation teacher unless he rings that bell, you know. And, you know, what's going on? Has he fallen asleep, you know? And what's going on? I'm sure I've been here sitting here for 2 hours now and, you know, just, you know, and it's, I can't take one more moment. And then the bell rings. It's, oh, good. And you sit still for, you know, 10, 20 seconds, and you realize nothing's changed. I haven't changed my posture. Nothing has changed. But suddenly the pain is kind of dissipated. It's not such a big deal anymore. We make a big deal out of pain by all the mental stories and commentaries and judgments and fears that come into play. Part of mindfulness meditation is to learn to see that so that we can become free of it. And the mind is really tricky. And it's fascinating to watch. And one of the best attitudes to have around this is a sense of humor. You know, the mind is just an amazing thing. Or a sense of awe or something. Maybe one more before we go on here. Anybody else?
Well, I just wanted to throw out something I read recently, which was that I think there's some study that's shown that along the lines of if people complain about pain, they've actually measured that they're actually experience it worse. That they physically feel worse pain if they focus on it. It's not just our imagination. And if they don't focus on it being a problem, they actually feel less pain.
I think that study had to do with chronic pain. And they're talking about people with chronic pain sometimes have better, you know, if it's going to be there anyway, sometimes it's better to be distracted. And along the same lines, I think the article said that having a solicitous, is that the word? solicitous a spouse.
Oh, yeah, that was it.
Made it worse. and to have a spouse that kind of basically ignored you and your ailments, at least, you know, and didn't want to, you know, just left you alone, actually. So I don't know about these studies so much. It was in the Chronicle, and, you know, sometimes you have to kind of read more carefully between the lines, or because they kind of don't always present the full view. But I'll talk in a few minutes about pain and how pain can be considered part of the meditation practice. So the word mindfulness, which is the basic word for the meditation practice we're doing, suggests that it's all about using the mind in some way. And I kind of think, you know, kind of a little bit loosely, that the word sometimes should be translated as bodyfulness. Because learning to be embodied, to be present for our life through our body, our lived experience in our body, is very central to the whole Buddhist enterprise of mindfulness, of vipassana, of a lot of different schools of Buddhism really emphasize the importance of being in your body. If you read some books about Buddhist theory or teachings, you don't necessarily get that impression. It can seem almost intellectual. But it's really becoming embodied and being in your body is a foundation then for the further work that's going to happen. Being comfortable in your body, being settled in your body, being experiencing the world through your body. And that's somewhat foreign to a good number of people who, for various reasons, because they're too busy to pay attention, they don't know it, or because they tune out their body because their body is sometimes a place of tremendous pain and suffering. Not just physical sometimes, but emotional. Sometimes by shutting down some of the body, people shut out their emotions they don't want to deal with. And I've met people who, you know, basically say, I don't really feel my body below my neck, or I don't feel my body below my waist. They've really shut down a part of their life. And the idea is to wake up in Buddhism, to wake up to our full capacity to feel, to be present in all aspects of our lives. So part of what the mindfulness meditation involves is to awakening to the fuller capacity of being present for our life through our body. Many of us are very present for our life through our thoughts and our ideas. The analogy I like to give has to do with a little story some years ago where I was watching football on television with two other Vipassana teachers. And I don't watch football very much on television, but, you know, we were there watching and I was with them. And at some point there was a commercial. And as I think reasonable people do, the teacher who had the remote hit the mute button. And so it was a commercial and we talked for a while. And then the game started again. And we turned to face television to watch the game. But the guy who had the remote didn't hit the mute button again to get the sound back on. Well, this guy teaches mindfulness. So I thought, he's mindful of the fact that there's no sound coming out. You know, he's present enough to know that. And he's probably, you know, I thought, I'll just go with this experience. I won't nudge him or anything. I'll just, you know, he knows that he's not doing it. So let's, I don't know why, but let's just go along with it. And so then we watched the game in silence for a little while. And then after a while, he did hit the mute, and then we had sound. And what was fascinating to me was the difference between the game with the sound and without the sound. Without the sound, I could kind of follow the game. You know, these guys, they stood up, they made these two lines facing each other, and they fell down. You know, and that, you know, not much to understand, you know. And then sometimes some guy would manage to have this ball, and you see him running down the field, and you'd kind of feel happy for him because, you know, he's going along, passing these lines. And then there'd be some guy who'd run out from the side and grab him and pull him down. You say, well, that's too bad. And you can kind of track. But when the sound was on, the biggest difference was you had the sportscaster making commentary, ongoing commentary. And I found the experience of the game changed very much because of the commentary that was going on. And I suspect that part of the job description of the commentator is to help the viewer get into the game, get excited. And in fact, that's what happened. Rather than this guy, you know, he's making it down past those lines, and look, he's getting to the end. It was like, you know, I'd be at the edge of my seat, you know, or standing if it looked really good, right, and really excited and everything. And it's kind of like canned laughter, right? I mean, it's not really funny sometimes, but the canned laughter kind of pulls you in and makes you laugh, or sentimental music or mood music that kind of makes the movie much better than it actually is. It's like this commentator is working and telling us, you know, all these things. But the commentator of the football game is not the same thing as the football game. He's commenting about the football game, but the emotional tone and the things they're being focused on and the team that the commentator is rooting for or whatever, all kind of influence, you know, what the commentating is. And it's different than the game in and of itself. So in the same way, we have a commentating machine, a commentator, in our minds. And many of us are living in our commentary about what's going on, either what's going on in the present, what happened in the past, what's going to happen, we think, in the future, or in some fantasy or other. But it's some, you know, we're running commentary of things. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but often we become imbalanced by we start living in the commentary, we experience the world through the commentary, and we lose track of the fact that the commentary isn't necessarily the same thing as what's really going on there. We think that our thoughts represent reality accurately. But our thoughts are just, you know, often interpretation, the commentary. Our comments change when we get new information. And, you know, on one hand, something was the worst thing that ever happened to you, but then you realize something else happened, you know, and it's a whole different story. It was different than what you thought it was. And so we sit here and we have a physical sensation in our body, and it can be a little itch on your thigh, and then the commentary comes in. And, oh, could that be cancer? You know, and, you know, I've had it now for, I think, about 7 seconds. And, you know, maybe I should make an appointment with my doctor. I think so. But which doctor? And maybe I should talk to my friends and get some advice. And you know, doctors are kind of expensive. And well, maybe I'll go see, you know, maybe I'll go get a book. Or maybe online there's some information about itches on the thigh. And I'll type in Google, you know, thighs, itches, and... And then you remember your computer doesn't work, and oh my God, the computer doesn't work, and I can't really afford a new one, and this is really bad, my life is really hard, and what should I do with myself? And I have to get a job so I can buy a computer so I can check online, because I can't afford a doctor, but I can never find good work, and I never seem to find work that's right for me, maybe what I really need is a therapy, because therapy is really hard, because that's expensive too, and I can't afford it, and I've heard that meditation is a lot cheaper, and basically could be free, you know. And I think I'll go do the meditation thing, and then you wake up and you realize you are meditating. You know, you just had a little itch, and you know, the mind has this amazing ability to kind of create this huge scenario. It isn't just like this neutral commentary, like the news. You know, it's like this whole world gets created of associated thoughts and all that, and we get carried along. And the sad thing is that, you know, we're living at sometimes like a, you know, many, many, many steps removed from actually what was primary, the itch, for example, right? I'm thinking about therapists now. And so it's like many generations away from the actual experience. And the sad thing is that sometimes my, you know, it's like a game of telephone also, you know, it's like further and further away. And so my 30-second commentator, my abstraction, is talking to your abstraction. You know, and we're not really connecting to something that's real anymore. So part of the function of the meditation practice is to learn to cut through the mind's tendency to live in its commentary, to live in its ideas, its judgments, and its associated thoughts, by doing something very simple. And that is to ground the attention to something which we know is real. You don't have to don't get into philosophy of what's real or not, but just in an ordinary way, what's real. You know, our physical sensations, our breath, the immediacy of what's happening now. And that can cut through so many problems. It can make us kind of come back to reality and start seeing it for what it actually is. And that's one of the functions of Buddhist meditation, is not just to help you become calm, but in becoming calm, to help you begin to see clearly what's actually going on, to see reality as it is. The argument in Buddhism is that most people don't actually see things as they actually are. They see it through the lens of their interpretations. I'm standing on a street corner waiting for a friend who's going to... We have a date, and the friend doesn't show up. That means my friend is a no-good, lousy bastard. Doesn't it? That's obvious? That's what it means? And then you find out, you get the phone call that the friend, you know, was on the way but had an accident and is now in the hospital. And all your anger dissipates, and you realize your anger was based on interpretation of the facts. It has nothing to do with the facts. So this is a very common phenomena that the mindfulness meditation is trying to help us to get a handle on. My favorite story like this is a Vipassana teacher by the name of Sylvia Boorstein was going to be a guest, wanted to be a guest at the San Francisco Zen Center. So she called up the Zen Center and said, I'd like to be a guest. And they said, oh, the guest manager is not in. He'll call you back. He called her back. She was not in. So the guest manager said, this is Robert. Give me a call, and we'll talk about you coming being a guest. So she called back to the Zen Center. Can I talk to Robert, the guest manager? No, he's not in. And then Sylvia said, oh, I think this means that it wasn't meant for me to come to Zen Center. And the person on the telephone said, Zen Center said, no, I think what this means is that Robert's not in. So we're so quick to assign meaning, way beyond what's actually, what's there. So part of the training in mindfulness is to come back to what's primary, to what's immediate, what's here. The body is very helpful for this. The body, the lived body, is actually a much better antenna, a much better reference point for what's real in our life than often our thoughts are. And so to actually learn to experience our life through our body, the tensions of our body, the pleasures of the body, the way the body picks up the environment, the way the body responds to the inner environment, to our psychology. The body is also a place of being, where we start feeling stable and at home in this world. We often start feeling that stability and that homeness in our body itself. So it's very important part of Buddhist spirituality is learning to be embodied, be familiar with your body, learning the skills to kind of come home to your body, to be interested in what your bodily experience is, to feel that's really valuable. And it can be very hard to feel it's valuable when we often have been trained, we've trained ourselves, or society has trained us, that what most counts will somehow be mediated through our thoughts. And so we're constantly kind of figuring out in our thoughts, what's this and what's that, and how many times can you relive a conversation, do it over again, and have a better rejoinder, And someone said once, forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. to not give such tremendous value to our thought world, the commentary, but to begin to find there's other places we can hang out and other places we can experience our life. It isn't that we make our thoughts our enemy and say we shouldn't think, but we don't make the thoughts the center of gravity. Rather, the center of gravity is our embodied experience, being in our body. And then the thoughts are part of it, but they're not the only thing going on. So if the breath is in the foreground of attention, be content to stay with your breath. If some bodily experience, sensation, comes into the foreground, then we make that the meditation practice. And that can become very interesting. And it gets a little bit counterintuitive, for example, if there's physical pain. Because we have a culture that emphasizes avoiding pain. Pain means something's wrong. Pain means I shouldn't have it. Pain means go for the aspirin, go for relief. At all costs, try to avoid it. And there's certainly something to be said about, trying to deal with pain in a realistic way. But if we're always trying to avoid our pain and dealing with the symptoms of our lives, we don't really understand the depth of what's really happening for us. So if you have a headache, for example, I don't want anybody to have a headache, but if you quickly go for the aspirin and don't really take stock of the fact that you spent the last 4 hours being tense, then you've lost track of what the source is for the tension. And if you're always relying on the aspirin, you're not taking responsibility for the way in which you're carrying yourself tensely around. So you're quite willing the next day to be tense, just to pull the aspirin down when you're ready. So that principle applies in many ways. By stopping and paying attention to pain, physical pain, it becomes a doorway into understanding a deeper part of our life, our psyche, our life, that isn't possible if we're trying to avoid the pain at all costs. So what can we learn from stopping and paying attention to pain? One thing is we can learn how to develop equanimity around the pain, how not to let our judgments, our fears, our commentary, our hate, our attachments, our ideas get the upper hand and pull us around by the nose. It's possible to sit with physical pain and at the same time have tremendous joy. or peace. It's possible. But most people don't have the experience because the commentary, the reactions, the judgments, the emotions that come with the pain are entangled with the pain. As you begin to bring your attention to the pain and actually be there for a little bit, bring some presence to that experience, you begin to tease apart the different strands of what's become entangled. So you see that the commentary on the television is different from the actual experience. You see the interpretation is not the same thing as the experience itself. You see that the aversion to it is not the same thing as the pain itself. There's a gap between the reaction and the experience. And that gap is a place where freedom is possible, where it's possible to find how to be at peace and restful with the experience. So part of the value of being with pain is we get to learn the whole ecology of the ways in which we react to it in unhealthy ways. And that's valuable. And if you go for the aspirin, the equivalent, you won't learn that part of yourself. And there'll come some point in your life where you're not going to be able to reach for something for the relief. Something's going to happen to you for some reason that you don't have some way of stopping it. And because you've learned to work with your pain in meditation, then you've developed the skills, the strengths, the inner self-awareness to know how to work wisely with the situation that's out of your control in terms of doing something otherwise. That makes sense? Now, maybe that's disappointing for some of you because I've known people who've gotten angry at meditation teachers when they said, be present for your pain, because it's so counterintuitive to much of what our society teaches us. Another reason for being present for pain is that the pain itself can give a lot of information of what's going on underneath with it. Sometimes the pain is there because there's tension in our lives, psychological holding patterns. Sometimes physical imbalances are going on. There's information to be learned from the pain if you really pay attention carefully to it. Sometimes the information we get is, this is not useful pain to hang out with. This is not useful pain to have. And so then we try to do something about it. But sometimes you feel very strong pain and you don't get that message that it's something wrong, that you're damaging yourself or that. And then it can be okay to stay with it. As we stay with it and bring more careful attention to it, a fascinating thing can happen. And that is, remember I said how we tend to live in the interpretations of the experience and not in the experience itself? We live in the concept of the experience instead of the experience itself. The same thing happens with pain. That we tend to live in the concept of pain more than experiencing the pain directly in and of itself. And it's often the concept we have around it which makes it kind of solid and difficult and oppressive. But if you can really bring the attention very close and not feel it as the pain, that pain over there, but start feeling it as particular sensations of tightness, of burning, of twisting, of stabbing, of searing, of hardness and all these different things, you'll start feeling that it's not solid. And actually, it's moving and dancing and arising and passing in all kinds of ways within a square centimeter of your knee or something. And if you really get close to it, you see there's a lot of intense vibration moving around. And you stop experiencing it as pain. And it's a really delight when that can happen. You don't have to sit with pain if you don't want to. And if you don't have some sense that it's useful to sit with pain, or you don't want to give it the benefit of the doubt a little bit to kind of explore that territory, then maybe you shouldn't. Then you can change your posture or do what you need. But sooner or later, if you continue with the meditative practice, you probably find that much greater capacities for freedom, for peace, for love, and all kinds of wonderful things in meditation come when you've learned to have the wisdom or the knowledge or the skills to be present for pain, to work with it, rather than avoiding it. But being embodied doesn't just mean being with pain. It means being with the delight of the body. The kind of irony, in a sense, is that if we try to avoid the discomfort of sensations of the body, to that degree, we also tend to shut off our capacity to feel the pleasant sensations, the wholeness in the body also. So in order to be really whole in the body, it's best to experience the whole shebang. The body also is a place that contains or holds much of our emotional, psychological life. And there's an expression, I think, by Jung, or maybe Freud, who said, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And that could well be. I'm not going to try to say something better than Freud or Jung, but in my kind of view, the body is the world road to the unconscious. The body is actually a powerful vehicle to enter into the unconscious realms of our lives, you know, that part of our life which we often don't track very well and so aware of. By learning to stay present in our body, not checking out from it, the body opens up and opens up to new dimensions. It's really great. So how do we do this in meditation? It's very, very simple. We don't try to have a big agenda. We don't try to kind of delve into the unconscious or do anything. We simply try to bring a very simple presence to the strongest sensation in the body when the body is predominant, when there's a strong, compelling sensation in the body. When the body is asking for attention, we bring our attention there. We hold our attention there. It can be very helpful to name the sensation that's there, very quietly, simply. Pressure, pressure, hardness, hardness. Pain, if that's what it is, pain, pain, or stabbing, stabbing. Sometimes a very calm naming of it keeps us from being too entangled with it, keeps us a little bit independent from the experience. So there's a little bit more of a meditative presence for it, more less reactive experience to it. We try to feel it directly for what it is. We try to be sensitive to how we're relating to that experience. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Are you pushing it away? Are you holding on to it? Are you judging it? Are you assigning meaning to it? Are you, you know, what are all the ways in which you relate to it? Can you notice what those relationships are? And can you let go of those which are not needed? So just be with it as simply as it is. Not for it, not against it, just as it is. It's a big undertaking, but by taking small steps and beginning to explore the meditation of the body, all kinds of benefits will come your way. One of the first ones I think some of you will experience is that just very simply you're trying to be with your breath and some strong sensation in your body is kind of knocking on the door and you're kind of feeling this tug, you know, this war within you. And that's that frustration or that tension doesn't have to be there. You can just let go of the breath and just let your attention settle there. And so you don't have that kind of fight or that push-pull. Just be there with the sensations of the body. Once the sensations of the body are no longer compelling, then we come back to the breath and be with the breath. One of the sensations of the body we try to be aware of, what we call a sensation of the body, are sounds. So if sounds become predominant, they're not a distraction from the meditation, they become the meditation. So the dog, your neighbor's dog that barks so loudly when you're doing your meditation every time, rather than kind of being ready to kind of wring the neck of the dog because it's interrupting and disturbing your meditation, it becomes the meditation. And you do a listening meditation, just being with that. Hearing, hearing, hearing. And one of the principles that you'll learn in meditation, this kind of meditation, there are no such things as distractions. And that is really great. It's just something else to be aware of, something else to stabilize and ground the attention, to learn how to bring presence to our experience, to what it is. Now, does that make sense? Or, you know, I should never say that because what are people going to say? In what way does not make sense? Does someone need some clarification or ask questions? Or in what way is this unpalatable or unacceptable? Do you have... Seem okay? Yes?
Your whole story of what our minds are doing, really, with starting with an itch and ending up on the computer, that's a distraction. But it's the noticing of it that's the point.
Noticing that's the point. And we'll talk more about thoughts in 2 weeks. So until then, you know, those of you who are, you know, do a lot of thinking in your meditation, you're kind of precocious. You're ahead of the game. So you know, you're not really supposed to think for another 2 weeks. But yeah, the principle you're saying is right. That the practice, we're not necessarily trying to stop to think, but we're trying to learn how to be independent of our thinking by seeing it very clearly for what it is. Oh, now I'm thinking, as opposed to being lost in it. But for now. In these first few weeks, just let go of your thoughts the best you can and acknowledge that's what's happening, let go of it, and come back to your body, come back to your breath. Be with your breath, be with your body. if you get distracted, the breath is always the default. Just without having to think about where to go, just go back to your breathing, and be with the breath for a while until it becomes obvious that some sensation in your body is pulling your attention, and then see if you can bring a meditative awareness to that experience. So it might seem a little bit foreign to some of you, this idea that you include all your body sensations as part of the meditation. I grant you that. And I think it'll become much more obvious in the next few weeks more why we do that and how it actually functions as support for the rest of what we're doing. So I don't want to explain everything, you know. It's like I can go on and on. And what I'd ask you to do is to spend this next week practicing meditation, this way of being with your breath and then your body, if your body wants attention. And then there's handouts out over there. They were meant to be passed out last week, and they weren't. So we have one first week and second week handouts. And the second week handout talks more about mindfulness of the body and has some exercises, homework, that you can do around your body outside of meditation. And you might find it useful to, whatever you can, to kind of be more familiar with your body. And the more familiar, more embodied, more familiar you get with your body, the easier it will be to learn how to incorporate emotions and then thoughts as part of the meditation. Anything else that seems important to ask? Yes?
Well, I have this chronic condition, so I have pain usually, but lately I've been focusing on it and I've just kind of turned it into like throbbing or, you know, sensations. And I'm trying to sit with it and pay attention to it because I think I've ignored it for too long. So
right.
That's why I have this pain. But then I get to the point where it's like, am I focusing too much on it?
It's a good question. I don't think you can focus too much on it in and of itself. But if in focusing on it, there might be other things that come along in the baggage. So if there's a lot of aversion, a lot of fear, a lot of self-criticism, a lot of doubt, that's really debilitating and kind of you're digging yourself into a greater, more and more tense or more and more just not useful state to be in, then it's too much. If you're kind of spiraling downward, then it's too much. And then you might want to break the spell and, you know, get up or do something else for a while and then come back once the spell has been broken, the cycle has been broken. But focusing in and of itself, you can't do too much of. But it's all this extra stuff that comes along with it.
It's like a tightness that I want to let go of. I'm like, why am I holding on to this pain?
Right.
You know, I'm like kind of focusing on it like, okay, when am I going to let go of this?
Yeah.
And so, what does it symbolize?
Yeah, so that might be interesting to explore in other avenues besides meditation. It's okay to do that, like with a therapist or something. But for meditation practice, it's best not to be involved in what does it mean, what does it symbolize, when is it going to go away. You know, don't have any thoughts of just be almost like dumb. You know, like, oh, there's pain, okay, I'm going to bring presence to it and really get to know it and feel it and be with it as it is. And if it feels like holding, like a tight holding, be very content that you're going to become, like, you're going to get to know that so well, what holding feels like, all the different subtlest permutations of holding, that by the time you finish with this, you can write a dissertation on holding. you're a researcher, you're a naturalist, you know, and you're not, your agenda is not to get rid of it. You will have that agenda. That's one more thing to be aware of, and try to become free of that agenda. Just let the pain be as it is. And you might at some point see it loosening up. Or what might happen is that loosening up of it will happen when you're not watching. But you had to watch it in order for that to happen. So, I've been there with pain, thinking, you know, watching it. Is it going away yet? Has it gone away yet? Has it gone away? And then eventually it goes away, but I wasn't there when it went away. So let's end with a couple, just a short minutes of meditation. Very short. part of the commentary for many people are judgments we have about our bodies. See if you can put aside any judgment or commentary you have about the body you have. Any ideas kind of from the outside in a sense. And then feel your body from the inside out. How your body is in and of itself, independent of any ideas or judgments of how it is. Not even so much as if you're watching the body from the head down, but rather as if awareness radiates from within the body out. The body itself is an organ of awareness. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. Or see if you can have a sense of presence with your breath, or discover the presence that's within your breathing. Instead of living in commentaries and ideas and stories, conversations in the head, see if you can take this time to live in your breathing body, as if that's your home, as if that's the place of greatest safety or importance. Let that be the center of gravity. The body breathing, one breath after the other. And then in the last minute of the sitting, do your best to stay with every breath, every in-breath and out-breath, not missing one. Letting the mind, the heart, become still as possible as you rest with your breathing. So thank you very much, and I hope during this next week that you enjoy your bodies and that your bodies enjoys you.